Welcome to Big Questions, an ongoing tour of the big questions of life presented by Winsome Media. Now let's get right to today's discussion with your hosts, John Quigley and Bill Cook.
Welcome back to Big Questions with Winsome Media. It's a beautiful day in Lynchburg, Virginia.
That's right. We're here on location.
Wow.
With a very special guest, but we'll get into that in a little bit. You notice in the newspaper today there's an article about a rather large Christian sect that's making an argument that's not going over very well, and that is that Christianity is not on par with all other world religions.
I saw that. I'm sure they're going to catch a lot of flack for that, but it's a big organization.
Yes, it is, and we won't mention the names, but you got to hand it to them that essentially what they're saying is that Christianity has something unique about it.
I would tend to agree with them.
I would too, very much so. They're saying that the arguments and the whole scope of Christianity isn't on par as just another religious concept as some of the other world religions that are floating around out
right,
there.
Right, and which a lot of people are trying to do, and all the religions have the same God with just different names.
Right.
Whether it be Jehovah or Hare Krishna, Allah,
right.
Pick one.
Kalki or Kali.
Throw in a few others.
Sure. Our special guest for the next couple of segments of Big Questions is very qualified to speak to this issue. It's Dr. Gary Habermas. He's a distinguished professor of apologetics and philosophy and chair of the Department of Philosophy and Theology at Liberty University here in Lynchburg. He's written at least 17 books. Many of them on life after death issues, including the resurrection of Jesus. He received a BRE from William Tyndale College.
BRE?
That would be...
Business Reply Envelope? What is it?
Bachelor of Religious Education, actually.
Aha.
Oh, okay.
Can you imagine that? Someone talked me into education.
You've been stuck there ever since?
That's correct.
Wow.
And you also have a Master of Arts in Philosophical Theology from the University of Detroit. A PhD in History and Philosophy of Religion from Michigan State University.
Michigan State? How did you get to Michigan State?
It was in my backyard and I didn't want to move.
I mean, Michigan State is not the end of the world, but you can see it from there.
From the end of the world? Yeah. Well, you know, it used to be an agricultural school. And some of my friends call it Moo U. So we take some of the same abuse in the Michigan area as Virginia Tech takes down here with some of the, you know, from other schools.
I'm a Lower Peninsula guy myself, so.
Are you?
U of M, only way to go.
We're in the shadow of U of M all our days.
We're very privileged and excited to have you with us.
May we call you Gary?
Absolutely.
Good.
Great.
Because Dr. Habermas is going to get tongue-tied after a while.
I probably would.
Now, we have another special guest with us today.
That's right.
Not near as impressive as Dr. Habermas, but still here.
Not nearly so special.
Dr. Mike Hart, who has his doctorate in jurisprudence, which just goes to show that we don't discriminate on the basis of occupation, no matter how sleazy, for this program.
That's right.
Mike is a lawyer. I've known Mike for quite a while. Mike is also a friend of Winsome Media and has volunteered... kicking and screaming, so to speak, to come and join us here for this interview as well.
We brought Mike in to ask the hard questions.
Yeah, we're going to drive the points home here. Thank you for inviting me today.
This is for the courtroom atmosphere, right?
That's right.
That's right.
Make it a juridical case.
What you can't see is what Mike's wearing, but we won't go into that.
Gary, this question of the uniqueness of Christianity, there have been books out that the uniqueness of Christianity is a myth. That it really isn't any different from any other religious philosophical system. What do you make of that? Is there uniqueness to Christianity?
Well, to narrow from a big picture to a little picture, before you even start, there are very few religions that have a linear historical view of reality. So most religions are either cyclical, and I don't mean by cyclical, you know, what goes around comes around. Events repeat themselves. Cyclical in terms of at their origins, they have beliefs in the changing seasons. You know, in the spring, the vegetation rises. It lives in the summer. It dies in the fall. And it's, and dead during the winter. But Christianity and Judaism for sure, and some would add Islam, are linear historical religions. That's interesting because in studies of historiography and philosophy of history, we often hear things like, it's the Greeks and the Jews. As one non-Christian text I studied made the point of saying, that the Greeks gave us historiography, the Jews gave us linear history. And, of course, we mostly know linear history today. So that's one thing right there, even the way they look at things, how things happen. But I would add that the claims of Jesus were unique among the religions of the world. I would add that the resurrection of Christ is unique. And based by unique, I mean there's almost no takers on either of those subjects.
Well, now, when we talk about the resurrection, though, we're talking about something that we can really only know from ancient documents, right? So from historical studies?
Right, unless you throw a couple archaeological things in here and there that help, but chiefly through witnesses that we find in the written word, right?
Don't you think some people would say that relying on history is a pretty shaky way of knowing anything? I mean, what can you really know about something that happened 2,000 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, the victors write the history books. I mean,
yeah, well, it's a theory that's out now, too, that happened in the early church. But, you know, we have a little saying, people who reject history are bound to repeat it and things like that. But I think it's more serious than that. For the person who rejects history, you're going to undermine all the other disciplines. Because, I mean, take Mike's, you know, legal profession. What would you do without precedent? And what are scientists going to do without former experiments? You couldn't run every experiment yourself from now on out, so there's got to be some trust in history. Everything, let's put it this way, it's self-defeating to reject history. And virtually every discipline, I think we can say every discipline relies on history in some sense. And its conclusions are no less knowable, I don't think, than other inductive procedures. Now, I'm not going to say history is a hard science or soft science. I don't think you can make the argument that history is a hard science in terms of repeatable and all that. But there's all kinds of soft sciences that are not provable in the laboratory, and yet they're highly respectable. And besides, just on a practical level, when I go to debates, I take a file folder with me with a number of skeptics from different disciplines who are thought to downplay history, but they don't. And every one of them, with these quotes I take, they think history is very important. And it's very hard to go about your discipline and not accept history.
So it's not an outright rejection of history, just a selective choosing from it?
Well, I think the only way someone's going to put history down just about is to say it's not a hard science, it's not repeatable. To which I guess the response is, so what?
Do you have an example of another science that would be a soft science that's not repeatable?
Well, let's just take one of the sciences that have a reputation for being a harder science. How about something like geology or paleontology? Their phenomena are largely drawn from records that, while they're there, while you can look at them, we might call it archaeology or something. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of dispute about orders of fossils or what does this or what age and all that, and yet they're right up there with the hard sciences, because you can repeat the tests on the fossils, but you can't talk about how they got there and what order and everything else. But when I say other soft sciences, I'm talking about highly respected disciplines like psychology, anthropology, social, you know, the social sciences. But I think history is, quote, harder than most of those.
Right.
Because we do have good data.
But even so, how would you respond to some who would say that history is but largely a record of interpretation of facts? How does a historical method work whereby we get beyond mere interpretation?
Okay, if all the guy's trying to say is history is made up of two aspects, facts and interpretations, I agree. But if what the guy wants to say is history is all about interpretation and only about interpretation, I disagree. The dispute that we're having today in the various sorts of postmodernisms, history fought that battle largely beginning about 150 years ago. And philosopher historians and an English historian taught that history was a hard science. And to discover history was to live history. And if you have the right tools and apply them the right way, just like the sciences, you get objective data. About 1880, that view, that by the way, was about 1850. Okay. About 1880, that view was challenged by Dilthey. And many of the players in this battle, by the way, they're thought of as historians, but they were actually professors of philosophy. Dilthey is an example. Mm. And he said, no, that's not true. You can't. And he went just as far as von Rad, the German, had taken it one way. History is what is, and it's lived fact and all this. Dilthey went exactly the other way and said it's all interpretation. Now I want to take you through, you know, Croce, the Italian, and Collingwood, the the British historian, and Beard and Becker, the Americans. But by the 1930s, there were a lot of guys out there rejecting history. And the thing backlashed because they realized it was self-defeating. And Beard, in his presidential address to the American Historical Association, it was 1934, 1935, he said, brilliant quote, he said, the historian who rejects history is bound to repeat his own errors, but even so, he's refuted by his own mind, because how's an historian going to say, history is relative, everything's relative, of course, what I just said is relative, so the whole process is self-defeating. And really, where it's ended up now in the last, say, from 1940 to the present, historians, right back to your comment, historians generally think that history is fact, history is interpretation. There's no fact without interpretation, but there are facts for interpretations. And so, where are you? You're talking about the best facts for the best interpretations.
It's interesting. Perhaps trial practice at law is nothing more than history, using that interpretation. When you go to trial, you're simply trying to establish what happened in the past. You have interpretation, which is the eyewitness commentary, and you have facts, which are the corollary things. You might bring in pictures of the automobile and the accident and showed how it was damaged.
Great. Yeah.
And you can support the eyewitness testimony based on those facts. You know the eyewitnesses are interpreting.
And Mike, how about precedent? You know, Smith versus Jones in 1972 said, and I remind the judge that and the redo of that trial was, it's all precedent. And it's I think you raise a great point about automobiles and whatnot. We might have photographs today, and you may not. But it's about evidence, and that's history.
Sure.
Right.
That's a great point.
And even photographs are taken from a specific angle with a specific viewpoint.
In photography and videography, it only matters what the camera sees. There are even data outside of those areas. So even photography is an interpretation, as it were.
Yeah, I might just bring this up, and I don't know where you guys all stand on this, and you could just roll your eyes when I say this and go, oh, no. But just an aside here. When these sorts of things come up about the resurrection, people say, well, come on, the reason that's respected is because there's photographs, and you guys have cameras, and we have tape recorders and everything else. You know what's a hot subject coming back in the news again today is the Shroud of Turin. And I've done a couple books on this, and I've gone full cycle from, I'm pretty sure to, not so sure. Since the 88 carbon dating, which I think is a serious objection to the Shroud, still think that. I was probably 60 to 70% range. But I just had to do an article for a journal just this summer, and I got to go to an international Shroud conference last summer to give a paper. Actually, this is an aside. I took a guy from the philosophy department with me from my school, and the guys in the department, they all sort of tolerate Habermas's views on the Shroud. He came back from the Shroud far more convinced than I was. Now, we heard paper after paper by chemist, physicist, medical doctor, over and over. And it seems the major theory of the Shroud today, the most popular one, even from some non-Christians who study the Shroud, is that the image on the Shroud, two Jewish researchers who are non-Christians, say that the image on the Shroud is made up of at least two kinds of radiation, a surface radiation and an internal radiation, X-rays, and that the image we see on the Shroud is chiefly X-rays from a dead body. You can see 20-something teeth through the lip. And the fingers that are abnormally long, and critics are saying, look how long those fingers are. Look, they look abnormal. Well, that's because you're looking at the finger bones all the way up.
Right.
And it just makes them have this ghostly appearance. And the other one is coronal discharge, by the way, the surface one that plays over the beard and things like that, the other kind of radiation. But it's fairly well received over across large circle today that of critics, even non-Christians, that the image on the Shroud is radiation. So when someone says photographs, yeah, but you don't have it.
Well, I have a friend who likes to refer to the Shroud as a photograph of the resurrection.
Well, there you go. That was my next sentence. I was going to say, so when people say, yeah, but we don't have that date in the Shroud, first thing I'm going to say is, but history is history, and when you have a good historical source, who disputes good historiography? Virtually nobody.
People who don't want to follow it dispute.
Well, that's good.
People who don't like the conclusions.
I will take it until you get too close with your religion, that kind of thing. But for those who say, but I like science, you got photographs. I just thought I'd throw that in there because maybe you're playing around with something like that.
It's a hot topic of debate even now, and I'm looking for it. I really haven't looked into it. But in the last week, this is the fourth time it's come up, so I'm going to have to do some
research. Well, that's an example because I think the topic's starting to come up. mm-hmm. right now.
What is the state of the carbon dating on that?
Well, there's probably 6 or 8 scientific comebacks that are really frustrating a lot of scientists. And I think of one guy who was an atheist, from what I'm told by a friend of his, so it's hearsay, but, Mike. But this guy supposedly...
Objection sustained.
This guy is supposedly an atheist, and he was one of the main formulators of carbon-14. And I have heard him say on taped interviews and television, this part's not circumstantial, I've heard him say on tape that he thinks they botched it. He thinks they blew the 88 tests.
Wow.
He thinks they should do it again. But there's some many other problems. One thesis is the Shroud was in a fire several hundred years ago. And if you guys watch the news, mm-hmm. it was almost destroyed just a couple of years ago with another fire. And the idea is that it displaces or replaces or adds so much carbon to the cloth that you're not going to be able to carbon date it, period.
Hmm.
Because the fire, the data are going to be forever skewed on dating if you want to carbon date, because the fire has made, I don't know what you call it, artificial carbon, or an artificial amount of carbon. Hmm. So it can't be done that way. That's a hot theory right now. There are several others. But one of the neatest things, the second thing that really raised the bar for me just this summer, and like I said, I've been saying 60 to 70% for probably 10 years. Mm-hmm. But one was the X-rays things. The other one was art history. It's been known for years that there are a number of painters who painted things that look like the Shroud, but abnormally mm-hmm. like the Shroud. For example, the guy in the Shroud has this upside-down pyramid triangle, whatever, between his eyes. That's an odd mark. His beard has, it's sort of a double beard. He's got the shorter one about here. He's got this longer one down here, and there's these two lines. And it's obviously a beard, but it looks like he's got a beard down here, too.
Hmm.
Now, the explanation is, and it's very clear, by the way, in the Shroud, but the explanation is that he probably had a face cloth that pulled the beard back like this, and so you have the part that comes out below the face cloth and the right. part back here behind it. Well, painters for years have put a double, not a double chin, but almost looking like beard and another line below that. Some just put this line across space because there's a wrinkle on the Shroud. Well, people have known that the Shroud's been duplicated, which only proves, critics will say, that somebody believed it was the Shroud of Jesus. Well, okay, sure. That's great. Unfortunately, those kind of paintings that look like they came from the Shroud are like post-10th century, and usually 12th and 13th, so right at the carbon-14. Now you're saying, no wonder it's been painted. That's when it came to light, and that's what people... But now, a recent argument has found 3 Roman coins from 692, I think it is, 692 to 704, first time Jesus was ever printed on coinage. Mm-hmm. Golden coins, Roman Empire, and I think it says King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and it's wow. Jesus. And 2 icons, one from Ravenna, Italy. Well, there's more than one in Ravenna, but in Ravenna, Italy, and St. Catherine's in Egypt. And these paintings have the same, the triangle. I've got a friend who owns some of the gold coins. And you can see the mark on the forehead, the double line in the face. If I showed you this picture and put the Shroud next to it, you'd say, incredible. Add this to your list of art history. Only here's the key. The coins are from 692 to 704, and the Ravenna, Italy, and Egyptian examples of art are from 550 A.D.
Okay, sure.
And so if they're in the same category where people just say, well, yeah, it's 12th century, it's a fake, now what do you have when you have 6th and 7th century, and if they copied, I think it's a huge blow to the carbon dating, which says we don't know what happened, but something happened.
Right.
To make the dating skewed, you know. So anyway, those 2 big moves, the art history and the X-rays, are tough considerations for me to blow this thing off.
You know, I think we've been discussing it, and we get wrapped up in this. We may have some people, and our listeners may not know what the Shroud of Turin is.
Right.
We might want to just back up and just state
that. It's a piece of linen cloth about 3.5 feet wide, more than 14 feet long, and it's been wrapped lengthwise around the body of a dead man, so that if the body disappeared and you open the cloth up, what you have is a long cloth with a double image, because the front part of the image is face to feet, and the back part of the image is back of the head to the bottoms of the feet. And so it was wrapped from head to toe. And so it's basically burial cloth. The image is quite clear on it. But what's even more clear is when you take photographs of the image, or back to photos, and you take photos of the Shroud, and that wispy, ghosty, this is what you've been studying for years sort of thing becomes... the minute you see the photos, because the image is extremely clear. So what you have is that the Shroud image appears to be a quasi-photographic negative, mm-hmm. of which your photograph is the positive. Wow. So it's a...
It is. It's an interesting study.
And I should say the man has Jewish characteristics. He's been an ethnologist, has said he is a Middle Eastern type, body type, facial type, and he's got all the marks of crucifixion from the, you know, piercing scalp, the face is badly battered, the lip may even be ripped up to the nose from one of the blows. Over 100 whipping marks. He's beaten on every inch of his body except for his face, forearms, and feet. He's got the five big wounds, two wrists, 2 feet, and a large side wound with a long blood flow that goes from the upper chest down to the waist and across the waist and the back.
Is there any indication of broken bones?
No, none. Well, the nose is very likely broken, but, of course, the nose is not a bone. It's cartilage.
And I understand that there's been some work on the pollen that's been found on it as well.
Well, that's been going on for 20, 25 years. But, yeah, there's pollens. The trial's not been out of Western Europe in its modern history, but there are a number of species, I think over a dozen. But the number of species of pollen from the Dead Sea, Jerusalem area of Israel, but it's not been out of Western Europe. So critics say, well, maybe they took a cloth from the Middle East. Well, why would they need to if in those days a person couldn't tell where the cloth was taken from? Mm-hmm. Secondly, they could say, well, the main thing they say is that there's airborne pollens. Well, there are airborne pollens that can go hundreds of miles, but why would, when they could be coming from Poland, England, North Africa, why do they seem to be coming from Turkey and Israel, which, by the way, the leading theory is that it was taken up to Turkey and brought over to Western Europe during the Crusades. Mm-hmm. I could add to the pollen that... got the possibility of coins over the eyes. This is much disputed. But those who are pro think you can read lettering on both coins, but especially the right eye. The name Caesar, Tiberius Caesar, it's a leptin of Pontius Pilate, but Caesar's misspelled. So,
What do you make of that?
Well, Josh McDowell, you know, he's a friend of ours, and he's been here, and I don't, you know, I disagree with him, but, you know, we're friends. Josh McDowell said, jokingly, but I mean, you know, he's trying to make a point. He said the only guy who would misspell Caesar's name would be a drunk coin producer, you know, stamper. But I tell people when they debated Tony Flew in 1985, back then, before the Carbon 14, I said, no matter how good the shroud is, it's not as good as historical evidence. So I still think it should be, you know, put in perspective.
Okay.
Okay.
So then what level of certainty then would you place the Shroud of Turin in? As historical evidence, then?
Well, if I go back just a little bit until just recently, as in the summer, I've been saying 60 to 70% to people ever since the 88 carbon dating, so 12 years. It hasn't settled in my mind yet with the most recent readings I've done on the art history and the X-ray arguments, but I would think maybe I've crept back up to about 80.
Wow. And how about the resurrection overall in terms of the historical evidence that's out there? And we'll get into that hopefully next time. But what level of certainty would you categorize the resurrection overall?
Counting the you mean shroud plus history?
Everything you could throw at it.
Well, it'd have to be more than 80 if the shroud's 80. But this is an interesting argument. Probability studies is a whole other thing that I think is really neat. But this is a hard thing to answer real quickly because I'm going to disturb some of your listeners. When someone says you think the facts are 95%, someone's going to say, nah, this guy claims to be biblical, and he says 5% chance the resurrection didn't happen. We're talking that when you throw your hat into the ring of inductive studies, you cannot get a higher percentage than inductive studies can yield. And by inductive studies, I mean all hard sciences and soft sciences can only get a percentage of probability, never reaching 100%. Mm-hmm. I do think Christians could be 100% sure, but that's a spiritual exercise, and I do think the work of the Holy Spirit is very important here. But if you mean just empirical data, I'd have to say the resurrection was high 90s. And by the way, I could even show you how you can get that with probability theory.
Interesting.
What you're saying, just to be clear, you're saying that when you answer the question, what's the probability, you're playing within a certain set of rules.
Right.
The rules of your particular regime of study and science, which is a different thing than answering the question about, am I a believer?
Oh, that's a good point, Mike. Because that's when you go to the doctors and he says, 95% chance we can take care of your cancer. And the person says, I don't want 95% chance. I want you to say 100%. And the doctors say, I'd love to say that, but I have to couch all my comments in line with science. So there are other life and death issues that we can only couch in probabilities today. And we're used to these things with cancer, for example. But you're right. As a Christian, and I don't just pawn this off. I just did an article a few years ago to patch this area up, which is a weakness in my own studies. But I did an article on the relationship between the Holy Spirit and apologetics. And I really do think the New Testament's serious when it says the Holy Spirit bears witness with our spirit. And we can know to a greater extent than what the evidence by itself yields. And again, we're not unfamiliar with that because we have the same conclusions in marriage. I can say, well, on the five occasions my wife's been out, I've never caught her with another guy. So the probabilities are pretty high that I won't, but my actual trust for my wife is greater than probability studies with X amount of cases where we or she has been out in public. So we're used to that kind of commitment. You say I do to a person, that goes beyond data. And Christianity, I think Christians can be sure.
Wonderful. We're going to look at some of those evidences. Next time we're together, Mike, I'm going to cut you off right there.
Perfect.
We've been talking with Dr. Gary Habermas of Liberty University, and Dr. Mike Hart has joined us. And Mike, you'll be back next time?
Indeed.
Are you sure?
I'm sure. High 90s probability.
Case closed. By the way, Dr. Habermas, you said you wrote two books on the Shroud?
Unfortunately, they're both out of print, but Verdict on the Shroud and The Shroud and the Controversy, 1981 and then again 1990, we have our pre- and post-carbon dating books.
Very good. So, listeners, if you want to find out more about that, hunt down those books. I'm enjoying this discussion. Let's pick it up
too.
Again next time.
Join us next week, listeners. We'd love to have you to hear the evidences of the resurrection.
Production of Winsome Media, building intelligent bridges to faith in Jesus Christ. For more information on Winsome Media, you can contact us at Winsome Media, P.O. Box 3388, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, 18017, or call us toll-free at 1-877-WIN-MEDIA. You can also check out our website at www.winsomemedia.org. And don't forget to tune in next time for more answers to big questions.